is Matthew Wayne Selznick, and this is Sonatotum, episode 103. Well, hello, my friends, on this and every episode of Sonatotum. What do we talk about? We talk about making stuff, mostly writing, finding success as we each define it for ourselves, and staying healthy and sane in the process. Who am I to be standing in front of this microphone to talk to you about such things? Well, I've been an independent creator, author, musician, podcaster, pioneer, since, well, by some reckonings, the late 1980s, and online since the late 90s. I've got novels and short stories and collections and nonfiction works out there on the market. I was one of the first podcasters. This is, in fact, my 20th year as a podcaster. And my debut novel was the first novel in history to have an initial simultaneous release in 5 different ebook formats, paperback, and free podcast editions in 2005. This is not my first rodeo. However, I try to approach everything in the spirit of an experienced beginner because, sure, it's not my first rodeo, but as I like to say it with me now, regular listeners, the venues and the horses and the bulls and the clowns keep changing. Every other episode, I feature an in-depth evergreen conversation with another writer on craft and on the 3 tenets of the show, making stuff and finding success and staying healthy and sane. And that's what this episode is all about. This episode, we feature Tom Carnell. Now, let me tell you a little bit about Tom from the bio on his website. Tom Carnell is a writer whose fiction has been featured in Swank magazine, Carpe Noctem magazine, and in the horror anthology Bloody Carnival from Pill Hill Press. He is best known for his insightful interviews and profiles in Carpe Noctem magazine, which, by the way, he co-founded, Fangoria magazine, and on Dread Central and twitchfilm.com. Carnell is a graduate of the San Francisco College of Mortuary Science, a certified eye and nucleist, and a registered polysomnographic technologist. And yeah, I'm going to have to look that up too. His novels, No Flesh Shall Be Spared, No Flesh Shall Be Spared, Don't Look Back, and the upcoming Monolith Records, and short story collections, Moonlight Serenades, A String of Pearls, Tuxedo Junction, Horror Book, Tales from the Lazaretto, and the upcoming Open Late, are all available through Amazon.com and Crossroad Press. He currently lives in Bellingham, Washington. And you can find Tom at, of course, TomCarnell.com. And by the way, Tom is spelled T-H-O-M. Carnell is C-A-R-N-E-L-L. So that's TomCarnell.com. Now, before we get into my conversation with Tom Carnell, I wanted to say 2 things. First thing, last episode, 2 weeks ago, episode 102, I tried to give away a copy of the chapbook edition of my latest novelette, Reggie versus Kaiju Storm, Dragon Squid Bat. Now, this novelette, it's limited to 100 copies, signed and numbered. And gold patron multiversalist J.C. Hutchins purchased a copy, even though as a gold patron, he gets one of his own, should already have it by now. He purchased a copy and said, hey, give this away to somebody who listens to the podcast. I did that. I said, hey, if you're listening to this and you want a free copy of the chapbook edition of Reggie versus Kaiju Storm Dragon Squid Bat to hold in your very hands, to have for your very own, I asked you listeners to just email me at matt@mattselznick.com before the 22nd of July. And I would choose randomly from the people who emailed me, put the subject matter, hey, I would like the chapbook or something like that. Include the word chapbook in the subject line. How about that? Nobody went for it. So I'm asking again. I'm really trying to give you something for free, for nothing. Something that's going to be, to one degree or another that remains to be seen, a collector's item. There's only going to be 100 of these, and one of these could be yours. So, you can go back to episode 102 and hear all about Reggie versus Kaiju Storm Dragon Squid Bat, or you can go to mattselznick.com, go to the written works section, it's linked right there on the homepage, and read all about Reggie versus Kaiju Storm Dragon Squid Bat. And if you would like a free copy of the limited edition, handmade chapbook signed by me, numbered, then again, email me at matt@mattselznick.com and express your interest in getting this free chapbook. Put the word chapbook in the subject line. And in the body of the email, be sure to include your shipping address, because if you're the person who's selected, I'm going to need to know where to mail this thing, right? Come on, people. It's a free thing, and it could be yours. I don't know what I got to do. All right, one more thing. Stick around till the end of this episode. I've got another deal for you. I've got another thing that's exclusive to listeners of the podcast. But you got to stick around till the end to hear about it. Okay? All right. Let's get into my conversation with horror and horrific fantasy author Tom Carnell. Tom Carnell, what do you create?
I am a writer. I was a publisher and journalist in the past, but now I'm pretty much focused on telling stories.
And what kind of stories?
It began as sort of, I grew up a lifelong horror fan, sneaking out, you know, when I was like 9 or 10 to see Night of the Living Dead at the movie theater, that kind of thing. But it's over the years, things have sort of mutated to more of a dark fantasy. I try to find little bits of unease and even outright horror or terror in the most mundane situations. I say that a lot of my stories in the novels are, they're essentially knock-knock jokes where I think of something and it makes me laugh. And I think, okay, well, that's funny. So let's put the screws to that and make that happen. For example, we were out with friends the other night and someone made a joke about a movie set in a old folks home. And he just did this trailer voice and he was like, rest home. and I was like, that's funny. And now I'm in the process of putting the screws to that to make it.
How can we make it horrible?
Yeah. And you know, I do that a lot. I do weird mashups sometimes that, like, especially for Christmas, I've done a mashup of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and Apocalypse Now. I did a thing where the first scene of The Godfather, when Bonastera asks for justice, transposed that to an elf asking Santa for justice, that kind of a thing. Taking little just funny ideas or finding the interest of the reader in things that they didn't think they could be scary. That's another thing. There's a story of mine called Assurance that's basically hunger is the monster in that. Let me say this. I grew up at the knee of my grandfather, and he used to tell stories all the time, and from the weirdest places, not stories he had read, but he would make them up. And that was something I did with my kids, like as they were little, telling them stories, making them up on the fly, incorporating, you know, aspects of things that they had told me. Say there was a fight at school. Well, okay, I'm going to set that there, and I'm going to make, you know, change it around to appeal to a child. Mm-hmm. And from that, now that the kids are grown, now it becomes about doing that same thing with just odd little ideas I have.
That's a pretty good segue into what is almost always my follow-up question, because a lot of people can, you know, as you have, as everybody has, they can talk about what they make and all of that. You touched on perhaps why you create, why you write. You mentioned your grandfather. Go a little deeper on the origin story there. Why do you think it is that you're driven to create in general, or specifically the horror, dark fantasy type stuff?
I have to think about that. It's always been that way. I mean, I grew up, like I say, with my grandfather, but through my mom was a big movie fan and music fan. And so mom would be like, oh, come and sit down. You know, it's an Esther Williams film. And I'd be like, I don't know what that is, but there's girls in bathing suits. So I'm in. So through that, I developed an appreciation for just the delight in someone, you know, going, hey man, you want to hear a crazy story? And I'm like, yes, yes, I do. Because everyone's got them. Even if they don't think they do. It drives my wife crazy. When we were dating, we would go out to dinner, and if there was an elderly person there sitting alone, I would insist that they come and join us, because I know they had stories.
Absolutely. You know
what I mean? Yeah. Yeah. So, and I think a lot of times we forget that about, it used to be that the elderly were our libraries, you know, mm-hmm. they were our repositories of stories of true and untrue. But it was just something like a drug, you know, where movies happened for me. And then I found like, oh, wait, they're telling me a story in this Pink Floyd record. And just sort of moving on from there, I'm a notorious eavesdropper now. I like going out to restaurants, my wife will be talking and I just don't recognize what she's saying because I'm busy listening to the couple next to us that are breaking up, that kind of a thing. And now I pose it to myself as challenges. Like, can you make this idea that you've had work? Can you bend it to your will? I talk a lot about, as a writer, as a creator, you're God for that brief time that you're creating, your God. I look a lot at my tales like, I saw something bananas, and now I'm going to sort of impart that to you in a way that hopefully is entertaining, mm-hmm. and hopefully will, in an odd way, mix the laughter and the horror. I interviewed Clive Barker once, and I talked to him about how the feeling in your chest when you are really scared and when you're really turned on are kind of the same. And he talked a little bit about La Petite Mort, the moment after orgasm, that it's the little death. And I thought, yeah, so that these things can live in the same space, right? The terror of this monster, along with the fact that in the course of him changing, he's got a party hat on. You know what I mean? That kind of a thing where you go, that's amusing, but still, it's terrifying as well. Can be.
You mentioned earlier, you know, the taking the sort of the knock knock joke, and that's the first thing I thought of was that the core of humor is surprise. You know, that laughter is actually a threat response. because we are, you know, our little primate brains or ape brains or even lizard brains are threatened by the sudden change of the status quo, you know, and that's laughter. And there really is obviously horror is also a change in the status quo. I mean, you could say that any kind of drama is that, but perhaps it's more closer to say it's an abrupt, unexpected, clearly threatening change in the status quo that makes it horror. I have no doubt that it's the same sort of underlying chemical reaction in our hormones that happens to both. And so your grandfather, your mom, exposing you to stories and exposing you to that wellspring in a way, and the drift toward horror and then dark fantasy, as long as it has, as you said, that sort of twist to it, that edge. What do you think brought you toward the darker stuff?
Midway through my teens, I lost all three grandparents and friends of the family, and it was like a ton of deaths in 1 year. And I spent a lot of time in funeral homes. And that always struck me because it was like, why would anyone do this? The little by little, my interest in what I was reading and what I was watching had sort of darkened in tone as I got older and into my teens. And then finally, when I was, 25, 26, maybe a little after that, I ended up going to mortuary college. And I worked as a funeral director in Balmer for about a decade. And that was one of those things where I just saw it like an aptitude. It's like, I've been around this. I know what this stuff is. And this is an opportunity to sort of help forge order out of chaos. That was my hubris.
Well, I mean, it sounds like a pretty valid coping mechanism. I mean, you were confronted with a whole lot of chaos. It sounds like in rapid succession in a short period of time.
Well, I'm also I'm a child of CPTSD, just mad craziness all through the years, and a lot of that has colored my work. It's all in the soup, right? All these experiences. I talk to my kids a lot about look. Change one thing and you change everything. So, I can sit there and go, well, I wish X, Y, or Z were different. However, it wouldn't have got me here talking with you today. What I mean? Yeah. So I'm kind of stoic in that fact where it's like, it's not succumbing to fates, but also knowing that it's hard to be a human. And we try to deal with it in ways that we can. And some of us paint and some of us, sculpt or write or, talk smack on the internet or whatever your art is. A lot of that stuff, I don't question about where does it come from? It just sort of happens.
I can relate. I didn't look too closely at that question for myself, for a very long time. It wasn't even on the radar. But in a previous version of this podcast, it was a little more less conversational, a little more directed, and there were five questions, and one of them was the "Why do you create?" question. And fair is fair. I had to answer it for myself when I did sort of a sample episode where someone else was answering or was asking me those questions, and I was in the interview seat, and kind of similar in some ways to your experience of being around CPSD, CPTSD as you're growing up, and the rapid losses and things like that, that for want of a better way to put it, the solid ground to quicksand kind of thing, and I realized that, I was never like physically abused or anything, but the family situation was constantly full of uncertainty between my mother and father. It's like he was always threatening to leave and never actually intended to, but the cloud was always there. So there was always like this, okay, we've got food on the table and clothes on our back, and there's always presents under the tree at Christmas time, but what's going to happen next? Always. I kind of figured out that, the only place, because I started writing, pretty much as soon as I could scrawl on those. I think we might be about the same age. Those landscape format brown triple lined pages they give you when you're first learning how to do your penmanship. So I'd been writing forever, and I realized, oh, well, that's when you're creating these worlds and these characters and these situations. That's the one place, you mentioned it yourself, where you can be God, where you can have control over what happens next.
right. And to mete out your own kind of justice.
And like you, it's like, it's not something I dwell on every day, or like, gosh darn, you know, wish it hadn't been that way. It's like grief, right? It's not something you get over. It's something you incorporate.
You carry it around like pocket change.
And it's there when you need to spend it.
Well, for a while there, I thought to myself that, you know, when everyone looks away, it's your job to look and investigate and look in deeper into all of that stuff. So a lot of times that put me in situations that weren't the best for me. Mm-hmm. But I knew, you know, I'm going to get a great story out of this. You know what I mean? Like being here in the bathroom, you know, sit in sit down stalls next to Jeffrey Combs talking while we both go to the bathroom. That, I'm going to remember that because it's so odd and so weird that if nothing else, I can tear that apart and take that feeling of awkwardness or that feeling of like, hey, I hate to bother you while you're dumping. But I talk a lot about, if you know, exploding schematics.
Yeah.
Like it's the car that explodes out. And you can kind of, I feel like moments in every story are like that, where you can, as the writer, as a creator, you can stop time, explode the moment out and walk within it and look around and go like, oh, wait, I didn't realize that he had that or whatever. And within that moment, you can kind of look around and go, okay, this is the angle I want to take on this moment. And then you can put it back together, snap your fingers, and it moves forward, and you go, yep, just like that. Mm. And that is a heady drug, especially for a kid who, you know, wasn't listened to and who most of my teachers ignored until like fifth grade. They gave everybody a test, and suddenly they went, whoa, your IQ is higher than we thought it was. So being not seen, this can be a way of being seen. It's just for the time it takes you to pick up a book and read the story that I've purposely made as long as it, you're going to be there in the bathroom.
Right.
You know what I mean? Yeah. I refer to a lot of the stories as, excuse the vernacular, but shitter reads.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, well, you can go in there and just open a story at random and start reading. And, you know, I don't have to get, I can get bogged down in the novels because that's what they're for. But short stories, you know, I'm more of a watchmaker. I'm trying to carve off everything, like Michelangelo said about sculpting, carve off everything that's not the story.
Yeah.
Carve off everything that is either in the way or something I've put in the way because, damn it, I want to see him wear a purple shirt. Like, no. And I'm not talking about that. Oh, I listen to my characters. That's psycho talk. I'm in control, but I can decide, like, no, wait a minute. He said this, so therefore he's kind of empathetic. So let's work that.
That's interesting because you had mentioned doing the sort of the expanded, you know, the exploded schematic sort of thing. In a way, even your time in the mortuary, literally getting inside in some ways, right? This is sort of a multi-part inquiry. Even with your shorter works, do you consider yourself more of a planner, plotter, story architecture person, or is it something that's a little more in the process? And do you think all of that, including, you know, as you said, putting yourself in situations that maybe weren't entirely the best for you or safe for you in the pursuit of the truth or the real answer or what have you. Mm-hmm. It all sounds like a quest for certainty.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. There was a time I remember working in Oceanside, California, at a funeral home there, where someone would go, "Oh yeah, you heard about, Babyland, where a lot of children are buried," and they're like, "Oh yeah, there's a little girl out there," and I'm like, "Where?" Because I figured my thought was, prove one, even a slice of this, and it all becomes true, right? So, removals and internments and all of that stuff, I was always waiting for some sort of glimmer, and feeling cheated when I didn't.
When the mundane pops up.
And you realize that 9 times out of 10, people can work themselves into all sorts of craziness. But for me, a lot of it is, like I say, the joke happens. For example, I was talking with a friend and he said, just off the cuff, "Drop the gun, clown." And I thought, oh, wait, whoa, wait a minute. And I started thinking about that.
That
And
does pretty much write itself.
So from that, I thought about it and what do I want to do here? And I talked to my wife for a long time and she thought I was crazy. And the result was a story that I did called Clown Town. And the pitch on Clown Town is a film noir set in a world where social structure is based on what kind of clown you are. So you've got like Harlequins as the upper 1%, and you've got white faces and rodeo clowns, juggalos, and at the very, very bottom, you have mimes, which are sort of like the black population at the Cotton Club giant. So I thought, okay, that sounds fun. So let's go a step further and create a jazz club called Marceau's, where the hierarchy of this world sort of comes in and out. It's rich in circus culture and jazz culture. And let's put a murder, or as I call it, a moita, that two Auguste clowns come into as detectives, and they have to, it's like an Agatha Christie drawing room mystery, trying to find the killer. That to me, what that initial idea was enough to make me go, hold on a second. The next idea was like, okay, now I have to do this. Now I have to dive into 40s jazz speak and, hophead culture, marijuana smokers. I have to dive into circus lingo, and I've got to dive into making a world that works. So from this small little chuckle, it gets under my skin, and the next thing you know, I'm banging out, listening to old Ike Quebec records and Buddy Collette records, and watching old YouTube videos of Ringling Brothers Circus from the 40s and the 50s. Great stuff. And from all of that came this sort of idea, not enough for a whole novel because that would overstay its welcome. Short story, or maybe even a novella, sure. Like we can get in, we can do a lot of damage, and we can get out. So it's from there, from little ideas. I talk a lot. I used to do a lot of work with local filmmakers, and I would tell them, like, look, stop all this. Give me a location that you have unfettered access to. Give me two or three actors and about a week, and we'll come back with something that isn't as mundane as what you're talking about. It's the zombie story that just is still telling the old Romerian model of, oh, mom is waking up. You can do that, but isn't it much more interesting to go, well, what else is going on? You know what I mean?
You're in a way, you're rephrasing that classic bit of, that old saw, throw away your first five ideas. And for me, I call it the think like a 4-year-old, which is just, but why? But why? But why? Every answer you come up with, just ask it again and again and again. And maybe
It helps define it for you, yeah.
well, sure. And it helps you, for me, whether it's character or world building, or usually those two intersect, they have to, but it gets me past the easy ideas. Our brains want to go with easy. You know, our brains want to conserve as much energy as possible so that we can, you know, run away from the lion in the tall grass if we need to. but so, you know, we're going to be lazy by nature unless we keep pushing and pushing and pushing. And I think that's similar to what you're saying is okay, but go a little further. Okay, but go a little further. You know, yeah. when I'm coaching authors, which I sometimes do, one of the first things I ask is, okay, what is this story about? And they'll start to tell me what happens.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's not what I'm asking.
Yeah. Thematically, what are you talking about here?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, what are you trying to say? What does it actually mean? And those are harder questions, you know?
And I'll interject. And it's okay if its sole reason for being is like, I wanted to do a vampire riff. Okay. That's valid. Don't expect the world to come calling to your door. But, you know, and I think you're right. So much of what I consider like corporate media, you know, the things that you can get readily at like Barnes and Noble, they're a lot of the same. They're a lot of watering down. I had a problem with one of my recent books called Horror Book, where most of the early reviews were arguing essentially gatekeeping, like, well, it's not really horror.
Yes.
Hold on a second.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Who sets you up as that? And I get it. but I think it's too easy. It's too easy to go like, wait a minute, this doesn't meet my preconceived ideas of what this thing should be. So therefore I'm going to bitch about it. Okay. All right.
This comes up a lot on this show in conversations with authors and writers is that, you called it gatekeeping and to me, it's the genre expectations or, you know, everybody's, especially younger writers are so obsessed with tropes now. And this is a hill that I often plant a flag on, so I'll try not to stay on it for too long because, you know, people who listen to the show have heard it many times. but genre is a marketing tool. It's not it's not supposed to be a blueprint. Right. You know, and again, we come back to the, you know, there's nothing wrong with I just want to write an adventure story. It doesn't have to mean a damn thing.
It certainly works for romance novels. You know, I just want to write a romance. Okay, well, why do I have to justify my little goofy story when you get that out of just like, oh yeah, I'm right. Which I hear someone say, oh, I'm splashing in the puddles. Okay. All right.
Yeah, and look, there is an audience for that, and you know, both on the reader and the writer side of things, and hooray for that. You know, I mean, ultimately, yeah. I think, you know, as long as we're adding to the culture in some way, as long as we're providing some kind of interaction and giving some sort of experience to the person enjoying what we do or even let's not even say enjoying, just encountering what we do.
Yeah.
Then hooray for that, you know, but yeah, it can be a little frustrating. You know, I run into the same issues because I tend to work in, I think of them in terms of story worlds, not like I'm going to write a fantasy series, but like, no, I've got a whole fucking fantasy world. And yeah, there's six novels that I can write, and there's all the sort of side stories and all that. And not all of them might be in the same genre. You know, you can have a fantasy world and, like you said, write a mystery story. You can write a romance, whatever, but it makes it hard to market, right? It makes it hard to find that audience. Thinking in terms of all of that. And you're kind of a hybrid cross-genre mashup kind of guy. Mm. How do you find readers beyond the folks who are, you know, who are expecting kind of what they happily are fed?
I struggle with that because everything that makes me good at my job makes me terrible as a promotional person. Mm. Right? The arrogance that thinks that my little musings can be important enough to bind in a book. That kind of arrogance when you're out there trying to get people to, promote your work or do whatever, that can be hard because they view that arrogance as, or that confidence as arrogance. The reason I got out of journalism because of that, I got really tired of, I've been doing 3 to 5 movies a day since 1964. So I see a lot of stuff. And so it got frustrating to me when someone would be in the driver's seat of some project. And it was like, you don't even know who you're ripping off. Like, you don't even know.
Preach. You
know? And people get really upset when they tell you your story and you go, oh, that's, that's Deadpool meets The Exorcist. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, And that's exactly how it happens. We did a podcast once with a screenwriter, and we did an exercise where, given a word, that word was socks. Tell me a story. And everyone told their story. And I had gone off on this leap of socks in a dryer being separated, having to cross vistas of dryer fluff and all this other stuff. And I thought that's how it happens. Someone mm-hmm. says something and you go, oh shit, hold on a second. And that's great. That's awesome. And then it's up to you as the creative person to go, okay, now how do I put my thumb on this? I felt obligated to do a vampire story once. The only way I would do it was to figure out an angle, and that angle was, what if a vampire survived a nuclear holocaust and now he's traveling a decimated landscape with no food, but he can live forever? Okay, that's that I've never seen before. Mm-hmm. So let's do that.
But how do you communicate that to, I mean, that one, actually, that example there sounds, that's a pretty easy sell, I would think. Kind of a high concept, but, and I'm not saying in general, how have you, and you mentioned, and this is something that you struggle with. What do you think is the key to actually reaching the folks who you know would be the right community of readers for your work?
Hiring people is always best. I mean, Duke Ellington said, the way he put his band together was to pay everybody and everyone showed up. But that isn't reasonable for someone has their first few books out. So I think you can try to get people enlisted. I try to get out of people's way who have a level of expertise. Mm-hmm. So my concern is the creation and the editing, and to the point where I go, this story's finished, and I hand it to my wife and I go on to something else, because my wife is the one that's out there. Hey, if you can we do a signing? Can we do a this?
Oh, I see. Okay.
She was the one who, I came home from a golf club in the mid 90s and said, like, yeah, they have these magazines happening. And my wife went a little like Irving Berlin and went, that's a hell of an idea there. And then we did, that launched us doing Carpenoctum for like 10
right,
years.
Right. Yeah.
So, and that was weird because we were just kids. We were not, well, we were in our 30s, but it was like, I had no publishing background. I had no interview background. Our first few issues of Carpenoctum, I wrote under 9 pseudonyms.
yep.
And no one got it. Like, my game reviewer was Ben Richards from Running Man. Yeah. Naming serial killers and stuff, whatever. But because it's hard, especially in a writer's world, I'm a big guy and I talk a lot of smack and I've seen a lot of stuff, and so it's tough. Because when you're walking into a room of writers and it's like, who let the dog in, right? From Ghostbusters. So I don't know. It's a stone I polish a lot. Because it's hard not to be extreme when the other position is naive. I remember my first book when I thought, oh, this is going to be awesome. I'm going to put this book out. People are going to go crazy. And I'm going to be leaning across the table going, well, John Stewart, let me tell you about my book. And none of that happened.
No.
And so I was crushed for, I had it developed between my first book and my second. There was like 4 years there where I was just like devastated over it all. Because, you know, you pour your heart into your first book, you know, pimples and all, but when it wasn't received the way I wanted it to, it really bummed me out. And then I realized like, oh, well, okay. Well, who cares? At some point you have to think, who cares? Like, who cares that I'm not going to be a Stoker winner? It's okay if I put out nothing else but just these books. And for me, if in the future, in a used store or something, someone goes, oh, what is this thing? This has got a cool cover or what have you. And they take a chance and it changes them or they somehow affects them. Job done. Mission accomplished. Because I could care less about, like, I want to be financially secure enough to do what I want to do, but I could care less about all of this big money hustlers, rustlers stuff. Because otherwise I'm going to be crazy. I'm going to be sucking up to people that have no reason to be sucked up to. I'm going to compromise my vision because someone tells me that, I don't know, you know, that clown story sounds kooky. And it becomes almost like an act of defiance for me, where I fought my way into this room, you know, with the, when Carbonoctin went under, we were jacked. We had run the entire project from our checking account. It was a disaster, but it still motivated me to, you know, to keep going because there was enough.
Right.
You know, there was enough for someone to go, man, dude, you know, and then when the reviews start happening and you think like, oh, wait a minute, this isn't just my friends. Because I always distrust that.
Yeah.
I don't listen to my friends about anything because they've, you know, they're poor tasting friends. But I like them to read it. I like to get feedback. Who doesn't? But I also talk about how I never learned anything from a good review. So I'm not begging for bad reviews, but I want to know what's wrong so I can fix it.
Part of what you're talking about is that and it's funny, this is another theme that pops up an awful lot, is the concept of the noble delusion, right? We just have to believe that what we're doing is worth doing.
I'm proud to be Don Quixote.
Well, you talked about arrogance and then you switched it over to confidence. And I think that's important. I think if you're thinking about it as you're being arrogant, then that's some imposter syndrome slipping in. You're judging before you've been judged, you know? But no, it's look, we all have a perspective that is our own that could be of value to somebody else. And that other person out there in the world won't get to advantage, you know, to experience that, to have that advantage. Unless we actually do the thing and get it out there and believe that person's out there. And I think you did answer this, is how you define success for yourself and when it comes to your creative life, your writing life, but also where you think you are on that path.
Success. Success to me is I continue to put out books. I or anybody else doesn't lose any money on a deal. I get that feeling of success when you hit that, you know, that last period. I'm like, I am the bomb for the next couple of days. But past that, money isn't too important. My time in working in funeral homes showed me that. Mm-hmm. You know, paupers and princes I put in the same box. So
yeah.
All that stuff. I fought ego most of my life. And then right around the time I was putting out the first book, and while I was sort of finalizing that first book, I was in my 50s and I jumped headfirst back into martial arts. And that led me to, you know, classes at 3 a.m. at an Office Depot someplace. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And that has held me in good stead throughout my career, unfortunately, it breeds that other thing. Like, you know, I wrote a book about fighting, so I went out and learned how to fight. When I run into people that haven't done that and haven't put their own butt on the line, I don't want to hear about it. And I'm not necessarily like a method guy where it's like, oh, I need to go out there and feel it, but I need to know what I'm talking about. So often we get told as writers, write what you know, and then we proceed to go out and write everything we don't know, especially in genre, right? It's like, oh, you're telling a story about a guy with a machete. Have you ever held a machete? You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, sure.
I'm a big sense guy. So it's people, I've heard the argument that it's imagination. It's like, yeah, is it? I don't know. At this point, you know, through the magazine and then working for Fangoria and all these other places, writing is just so ingrained. You know, it started back in Prodigy, where I was on Prodigy giving my, you know what I think about this movie. And now it's such a part of my day. I get my words done pretty early in the day before I get distracted by, you know, I still follow all the movies that come out. I buy a ton of records and put them up on my Facebook page every week. I don't know. I feel like, I don't have a lot of time for ego. I don't have a lot of time for these ask me anythings, or, you know, I'm happy to ask someone a question, but, you know, come on. I'm not a fan of the star, the, you know, the writer of the week or whoever else. I'm a guy who just recently I went, and since I was doing short story collections, I went out and bought and read all of the books that have ever read a Stoker for best collection. Mm-hmm. And not all of them are great. So, okay, cool. But you doing that research, I think, is so important, where other people will rely on their imagination of what it was like to be a peasant in the 15th century. The real guy is the research hound that is out there. And that's where he's the best, where he's digging up all this cool information. And I equate writing a book or a story as building a house. Your story is your foundation. Your first draft is your framing. And then as you go through it and you're adding things, electricity and sidewalls and all that other stuff, when you're down to like adjusting picture frames on the wall, you're done.
Yeah.
So for me, it's a lot of that. I shoot an arrow through the trees and it goes all the way to where the end is. And then I'm just following that lead the rest of the way, hacking away what's not important, hacking away that's going to give me or the reader the best perspective on this. Because for a brief shining moment, it's the most important thing in the world.
Right. And so you're pretty satisfied with that. You feel good about it.
I am satisfied with that. Yeah. I don't want to look at my work and go, you underperformed. It's like, no.
No, that's
great. Some things just aren't for you, or you, or you, or you. So rather than be a hater, just go, that did a real turnaround. You know, a few years ago, I stopped. I'll tell, like on social media, I put up every night, this is what we're watching. And I used to give a review of it. I don't do that anymore. Because, you know, when you lose a couple friends over your opinion of Star Wars.
Right.
You know, and you kind of go, okay, I get it. It's something dear to you, but you know, come on.
And you can put that energy into more productive things, more, sure, more enriching and nourishing things for yourself that ultimately, mm-hmm, I would assume adds to your art. Right.
Right. Right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And so often in this day and age, they follow the work, but they also follow the person.
Right. You know what I mean? Yeah. And so I think
if you're off-putting, so
that's the one thing that I've kind of clung to, just kind of, you know, to do a callback to the, how does the multi-genre crossover writer find their tribe? That's the one, mm-hmm, thing that I've found is really the only constant is people build communities around the author. They might love, mm-hmm, this book or that book, but they want the author to succeed. because then they get exactly. more stuff from that author, you know?
Right. I remember a guy I was talking to about how he had just gone from doing some zombie books to like an alien invasion book. And he's like, I don't know if my reader is going to follow me. And I told him, I go, that's because you made that book the focus rather right, than you right. the focus.
Yes. Yes. I mean, it sounds terribly pragmatic and smarmy, but it's the old marketing saw of people will buy or endorse or buy into something that they know, love, and trust. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's no reason that that can't be you as a person who is also you as an author. Yeah, for sure.
Right. So little people talk about brand, you know.
Well, they talk about brand like it's something terrible to say when it doesn't have to be terrible, though. You're simply defining how you are received by the people that you are trying to reach. That's it, you know. And granted, capital P personal brand, capital B personal brand. That has been subverted, but those are the people who aren't being sincere and, mm-hmm. and authentic, you know, they are creating a persona, you know?
Why equate all of that to like gripping a handful of sand? Like you really want all of that sand, and the tighter you grip it, the more slips to your fingers.
Exactly. Yeah. I'd rather we all just hang out on the beach together.
I agree. I learned early on in studying some Filipino stuff about how if it feels like work, you're doing it wrong. Mm. It should something, there's a flow, and you have to, the flow is never going to adapt itself to you. You have to learn the flow and the rhythm of the flow and to be able to go, this is how I navigate this, or whatever metaphor you want to use.
One of the tenets of the show is, you know, the last line in making stuff, finding success, we each define it. The last line is, and staying healthy and sane in the process.
Yeah.
So, you know, as deep or as mundane as you want to be about it, what have you found there that's working for you and helping you kind of keep the even keel in whatever way you want to define that?
What have I learned? Never take it personally, because, you know, there are people out there. You know, I there was a time when it would be like, oh, how dare they not want to talk to me? Get real. Kill your ego, kill your TV. Look, I've always had the perspective like, this is all wrapping up for all of us.
Yeah.
And so,
memento mori, right?
Yeah. Yeah. For a while there, I was really concerned about that. And I would use words in open conversation like legacy, which is utterly boneheaded. But and then I just realized, like, wait a minute. I make widgets. And sometimes they're long and big and small and short. And sometimes they're scary. And sometimes they're action-y. But whatever. They're just things that I make, and I put them out there, and I do whatever I can. I go through whatever doors are presented to me. And I'm watchful for those that, with less talent, for want of a better word, who will undermine my own. These days, I used to be a really social guy. These days, I don't go out. I don't leave the house. I do my work. I live my life with my wife. I visit my daughter. And that's kind of it. Because for me, it's a better outlet than the days when I was like, you know, younger and more hot-headed. so as the years go by, it's just an expression. Bruce Lee talked a lot about the art of expressing the human body. And this is just my expression. And part of my expression is not that I'm going to sit there and have big meetings with guys in suits. Cause I'd much rather talk to the janitor than the guy in the suit. Sure. So for me now, I've sort of become content in the idea, like it'll happen or it won't. Like people, the books will become a more and more of a success, or they won't. None of that is an expression of or a condemnation of me.
Right.
Because I did my level best. I was talking to, again, Clive about writing and editing and polishing and polishing and polishing. And he just, I remember he said to me, at some point you have to say, that's the best I could do right now. Absolutely. And take all of that energy and pump it into this new thing and make that one better.
Yeah.
When someone comes in a review or something says, oh, I didn't like that story, I just kind of go,
Okay.
Because for me, it's a Rodney Dangerfield joke that didn't land. All right.
Yeah, there's going to be more.
Yeah, there's going to be more because I'm not stopping anytime soon. I've got my to-do list right now is bananas.
Yeah.
So, and until my, you know, my mind holds, we'll do this forever and not, even if it means putting it out myself, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think it's, as I get older, it's a piece that I try to find. And I used to be drawn to intensity. Hmm. And now, I run from it because I don't want to be involved. And I just don't want
to. It's going to distract from what matters.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, bring it into my house and then that'll be different. But for me now, it's about, I would much rather just sit like this with you than to be at a party with you.
Right.
You know what I mean? I don't operate that well. I'm a big person. I get big. My arm gestures are big in Italian. So it's tough. It's just really tough. And so instead of fighting all of that, I just decide I'm just going to do my work because my work always gives me fun, even when, you know, what I'm doing is ridiculous.
I think that's so important too, is, I mean, to sort of encapsulate it, you've figured out who you are and what works and what detracts.
Well, I think being a writer is inherently lonely and, you know, being online and all that other stuff can mitigate that a little bit, but it's still a lonely profession and you need to be lonely. You need to be all of those things. So when I see hot, big presences, I start to go, you know, it always reminds me of something Jack Ketchum, AKA Dallas Mayer, said about how if you're in this business to get rich or get famous, do us all a favor and fuck off.
Yeah.
and I really take that to heart. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I wanted to swing back. My ears perked up. Because you mentioned that, you know, legacy was a boneheaded idea, but I also recall that you said, you know, if somebody years from now finds one of my books in a used bookstore and picks it up and thinks, oh, this is something, isn't that legacy?
Look at you calling me out on this, on my own bullshit. Yeah, I guess it's the, I think one happens sort of outside of yourself, and then what I think one happens inside, where like unconscious of legacy.
Gotcha. Yeah.
But the other, I think, just sort of, it's the echo or what have you.
If you're just doing the work and the work presents itself, then you've taken care of it.
Yeah. I mean, I talk a lot about how I write a story, I put it out there, and that is the end of my involvement. How it is to be interpreted is not up to me. Amen. How little things, people have come up to me and go, oh, I really like that thing that you did right there. And I'm like,
you nod sagely, like, yes, yeah, I'm so glad that you liked that thing that I certainly did. Absolutely did.
I am very wise.
Yeah, it's happened to me too.
All the time.
But that's the beauty of it. That's the collaborative nature that happens between the person who creates the art and the person that actually makes it art, the person experiencing it, you know? Yeah. So one of the things that I like to ask, it's as corny as this gets, I promise. But if you could take everything that you've absorbed and learned and all the expertise that you've gathered and the backs and back and forth and the ups and downs and all of that across your creative writing life and distill it down to, I don't know, a bumper sticker, a coffee mug. What do you think it might say?
Luckily, I put out bumper stickers
in the past. You've got a leg up. Go for it.
If you're not enhancing my time, you're wasting it. Mm-hmm. For example, I'm working on something and I'm doing, there are things that are going to help you and things that are going to hurt you, and learning the difference and learning how to divide them, you know, chop them in half and push the things that don't matter out of the way. That is the backbone of that.
It's that stoicism again. Yeah.
Yeah. There's, I mean, you know, like I said before, it's like, I've seen so many captains of industry, you know, with their hands crossed over their chest, and it was just like, it really did a thing, you know? Yeah. And in my own life, I, you know, family members who have planned for their, you know, their old age, and then some, you know, that one thing happens.
The metaphorical and then bus just, comes along, and yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And so you see that enough and you just realize like, oh, I get it. While it intensely matters to me, it doesn't matter. So stop thinking that it does, because it, you know, no one, nothing is going to turn in the world because I wrote a story on zombie fighting. You know what I mean?
As far as you know. So is there anything that over the course of this conversation that maybe we touched on that you wanted to elaborate on, or thinking back, you're like, oh, I really wanted to expand on this, or anything we missed that you don't want us to miss?
No, I think we're good. I don't have an agenda. I do interviews just like, I don't make any prep. I just.
Oh yeah. No, I understand that. It's just like sometimes stuff will come up, and then in the process of the conversation, you're like, oh, but I was going to say this about that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, all the things I was going to say would get me in trouble.
Well, this has been the best. I think that there's a lot that we've covered that folks are going to find value in, whether they listen tomorrow or 2 years from now, which is the whole point, getting a nice evergreen, high value conversation for not just writers, but, you know, mostly writers. And so, Tom Carnell, thank you so much for being on Sonatotum.
Thank you.
Well, there you have it, my friends. There's my conversation with horror and horrific fantasy author Tom Carnell. I hope you enjoyed that. I had a blast talking to Tom. Our conversation occurred back in January 24th, 2024. Oh, and by the way, today is June 25th, 2024, as I'm speaking to you today from the lush and lavish studios of MWS Media here in Huntington Beach, California. Tom and I had a blast. We talked for over an hour and a half, and I had to regrettably cut about a half an hour or more, almost 40 minutes, I think, of conversation from the public version of our talk, the thing that you just heard. There was just so much, and we went on a couple of side tangents and some rambles and a little bit of gossip. Still, the version that you just heard, re-listening to it as I was editing it a couple of days ago, it really struck me how much of a through line mortality and, you know, memento mori, the do not forget that we must die, is a factor in Tom's work. From his subject matter, the horrific, of course, and surprise, and the elements of surprise, and the connections between the horrific and humor, but also in his sort of bumper sticker slogan, you know, if you're not enhancing my time, you're wasting it, because as I often think, we only have so much time, right? Whether you're 18 or 81, it could all end in a flash, right? So make the most of it. Tom certainly seems to be. And I hope that our conversation inspired you. If you enjoyed that conversation with Tom Carnell, if you dig Sonitotum and what I try to bring you every couple of weeks, I hope you'll consider leaving a rating, and even better yet, a review, wherever it is you get your podcasts, wherever it is that you listen to this show, whether it's Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts, right? iTunes, Spotify, YouTube now has a podcast feed that this show is available on. I use Podcast Addict on the Android phone. Wherever you listen to podcasts, if you could take just a few seconds, give this podcast a rating, you know, 5 stars is always great, but whatever you feel it deserves. And if you have a little more time, go ahead and write a review of Sonitotum. Tell the world in your own words why this show is something other people should listen to and why you dig it. If you would like to leave a comment about anything that Tom and I talked about, you can, of course, do so in the show notes for this episode, Sonitotum 103. You can just go to, you know what? You can go to sonitotum.com, sonitotum.com. And that'll take you to the podcast page right there on mattselznick.com. And you will see episode 103 is right there at the top. Assuming that, you know, you're listening kind of around the time that this episode comes out. If it's been months or years, you will find Sonitotum 103 there in the archives. Just go to sonitotum.com and it'll be right there. You can leave a comment in the comment section for this episode, episode 103. You can also, of course, send me an email. We talked about emails earlier in this episode, remember? At matt@mattselznick.com, matt@mattselznick.com. You can also record a little voice message, maybe on your phone, and email that to matt@mattselznick.com. One way or another, I will respond to everything that you send me, and we'll have a little extended conversation about my conversation with Tom Carnell. So, hey, rating and reviewing the show, as I mentioned, is a great way to support the show. If you have the means to go a little farther and you would love to get a lot of extra access, for example, hear the entire conversation I had with Tom Carnell, the entire hour and a half plus, and other exclusive stuff, then I hope you'll consider becoming a Multiversalist patron member. Patron membership starts at $5 a month, but if you pay annually, $50, it works out to about $4.17 a year. Patronage really, really, I cannot stress this enough, really helps this show and my own creative endeavors, not only monetarily, because this show costs literally hundreds of dollars to produce every month. There are 2 episodes a month. And I spend, depending on what expenses come due in relation to all the tools and services and platforms that I use to make this show, it could be anywhere between $200, $300 on average per month. So your $5 or $10 or $25 a month, your $50 or $90 or $200 a year, which of course is a great way to save a little bit on your Multiversalist patron membership, that money makes a substantive difference in my life. Because that money has to come from somewhere, right? To make this show. But also, and really, equally or more importantly, your patron membership feeds my soul. And that sounds corny, I know, but it's true. When I know that you're out there, that you have committed to the success of this show, committed to the success and the ongoing endurance of my pursuit of creative endeavors, I'm thinking of you when I'm making stuff. I'm thinking of my patron members. Here's the people I'm thinking about right now. Zoe Cohen Lay, JC Hutchins, Ted Leinhart, Amy Bowen, Jim Lewinson, Charles Anderson. Join them. Go to mattselznick.com/be a patron. mattselznick.com/be a patron. Thanks for that. All right. Let's talk, as I promised, about something that I want to give to you. And that something is 1/3 off one of the many services that I offer authors and writers. That's my day job. I provide help to creators of all sorts, mostly writers, helping folks bring their works to fruition, to market, and to an audience. And one of those things that I do is called Your Story Buddy. Now, I'm just going to read right from the pitch on my website. Maybe this is something you want. Okay, I'm not just going to read from it. I'm going to ad-lib a little bit because I don't like reading from a script. It sounds stupid. So listen, if you're a fiction writer and you have your group of advanced readers, which is great, right? Once your short story or your novel or other work is finished. But what about while you're deep in the weeds with your fiction and you're tangled, stuck? What about those days, the suggestions of your critique group, which is also another awesome tool to have in your kit, right? But what about the days when the suggestions of your critique group, they just don't land and you don't even know why? You need, my friends, a story buddy, and that's me. Here's how this works. Over phone or Zoom, we're going to spend an hour discussing your work and the specific knots you're trying to untie. I'm going to use directed questions and experience-driven insights and suggestions to guide you to discover ways to strengthen the storytelling bones of your piece, excavate, construct, buried, fragmented thematic opportunities, coax out undeveloped character depth and motivation, and the proverbial more. Of course, the specifics are going to depend on the work itself. It doesn't matter. By the end of our conversation, you will see your work in ways you hadn't before. And you'll have new ideas and a new outlook from which to proceed. That's your story buddy. I am your story buddy. So if that sounds good to you, if you want to sit down with me over the phone or over a Zoom call and really figure out that one thing that's stopping you in your current work of fiction, I've got a deal for you. So normally your story buddy is $75 for the hour. For Sonatotum listeners only, I'm bringing it down to $50 an hour, so long as you book your story buddy session sometime before the end of July 2024. Now, we don't have to actually have our meeting in July. You just need to make the booking before the end of July 2024. This is an offer that I am only talking about right now, on the microphone, in the episodes of Sonatotum that come out between now and the end of July. I'm not going to promote this anywhere else. I'm not going to talk about it anywhere else. It's not going to be on the website. It's just for you, dear listener. Go to mattselznick.com/podcast-0724. mattselznick.com/podcast-0724. What that's going to do is redirect you to the booking page for your Story Buddy, the special one-third off offer for your Story Buddy. This is only for listeners of Sonatotum. Take advantage of it. I know a lot of you are fiction writers, and it doesn't matter what stage you are at in your writing journey. You'll see testimonials there when you go to mattselznick.com/podcast-0724. People who've been writing for 40 years and more, and people who have not yet even published their first novel. I've helped them all. I can help you. It's only $50. It's normally $75. mattselznick.com/podcast-0724. But you must make and pay for your booking before the end of July 2024. I look forward to talking with you. And that's it for now, friends. I hope you enjoyed the conversation with Tom Carnell. I hope I find emails from you in my inbox saying that you're interested in getting the free chapbook edition of Reggie versus Kaiju Storm Dragon Squid Bat. I've got one to give away, but I need you to tell me you want it. And I hope that if you are a writer struggling, who needs a completely objective outside voice to help you get over whatever it is that's keeping you from finishing your current work in progress, I hope you'll reach out, take advantage of the July 2024 promotion, one-third off my Your Story Buddy service at mattselznick.com/podcast-0724. I'll be back in 2 weeks to talk to you again if I don't hear from you before then. My name is Matthew Wayne Selznick. Take care.